Hi, my name is Julian, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Julian.
And I'm really honored to get to speak here tonight on prompt two because this was my regular Saturday meeting. I have about eight months and a week of sobriety so far, and it's been a mixed road, but mostly easy for me. I was never really a heavy drinker until fairly recently in my life. I was raised in a family that has a history of alcoholism. But my mom was not an alcoholic, and she was warning me throughout growing up to be careful about alcohol because of your grandfather, et cetera, like that. I did speed most of my life, literally most of my life, starting at about 18. I'm a software engineer, and it really helps, or it seemed to help me with my focus. And so I was a heavy, you actually get less done, but it's such as it is, I self-medicated. I got married about 10 years ago and managed to pretty much cut all that shit out of my life. You know, you don't want to do that to your wife. Unfortunately, about four years ago, we got cancer and I lost my wife. And it started a period of me being lonely and socializing a lot in bars, you know, drinking, chatting with people, and just not being alone. But this is a progressive disease, and I gradually started to drink more and more, and frequently was offered a lift by like the bartender or somebody like that, because I'm a social person, and people tend to be nice to me, which is great. But it got worse and worse, and I landed a great job at Pinterest. It felt like, you know, the ultimate job to me, but at lunchtime at that point, this is just over a year ago, I started to go down to a place called the Hotel Utah, which is down the street, and drink a couple of two martinis. Actually, I was very accurate about it. You know, I had an idea of what I could do and get away with it, I thought, and then eat their chicken wings right after that because it could block the breath, I thought. I didn't get renewed on that contract. I didn't have to face the embarrassment of being fired or anything, but I think people have a way of knowing something's up. You know, so even if they don't say anything, they're just like, well, we just won't continue his contract. So after that ended, at the end of last summer, I just started to drink every day. I liked wine. I like to drink two 750 milliliter bottles of wine, basically. That's what makes you pass out at my body weight. And so I'd sit down by the lakeshore. I live in the lakeshore area. And I'd sit and feed the seagulls and drink wine until I passed out. And then you wake up, you get some more wine, and then you pass out again after two bottles. And I was just drinking 24 hours a day. It was a new thing for me, and it didn't scale very well. I got robbed, beaten up, not like severely like you see on YouTube, like just somehow I woke up on the ground without my trench coat, and people telling me, like, you should get that cleaned up. I'm like, what? Oh, yeah, this part of my face hurts, you know, that kind of thing. They're like, yeah. And so within a few months, by about February, I was kicked out of pretty much everywhere around my neighborhood. And I was having a lot of incidents where people were telling me I'd done something, not necessarily bad, just that I'd called them for help or I'd done this and that. And I had no memory of it at all. And these blackouts were really a big concern for me. That and the fact that my general lifestyle had gone to hell. I mean, I was sleeping at home on a pile of dirty laundry on my bed. My place was a wreck. And bad sleep hygiene has all sorts of other problems and doesn't help with your memory issue either. The worst, of course, was getting kicked out of Trader Joe's. Because I wasn't even sure what was going on. I was just coming out with a couple of bottles of two-buck chuck. It's really like three-buck chuck now, but that's what we call it. And this man coming over and aggressively saying, hey, I told you not to come back in here, and taking the wine away and walking me to the door. I'm like, well, tell me why. What did I do? I need to know so I can remember. He's like, just get the fuck out of here. So basically, I'd gone from like ordinary citizen to that guy. And we told you to get the fuck out of here. I'm sorry for swearing. The Heart and Dagger, at least they just gave me a 3 months. They're like, come back in March, Julian. You're drinking too much these days. Because they'd known me before. merchants, a place you'd never think a guy without tattoos or without anything could get kicked out. Banned for life. And that was for taking a friend into the women's room, because this is our secret, but they are always neater, and doing lines off the towel things. It was a good surface. Anyway, it went on like that, and people were starting to talk to me about AA. And I took the advice. Last March, I went. Well, first I told, I'm not going to state her name, but basically, or their name, but basically, I told them, I'm going to go to AA, and I'm going to, and she's like, you can just call it AA. I'm going to go to AA, and I'm going to go to your meetings, and I'm going to do exactly what you do. You know, I was obviously drunk at the time, but I remember that. And they said, well, you can't come to my meetings, because I go to women's queer meetings, but I recommend Rockridge. And she gave me an app that I put on my phone that we all know, and basically started to go to Rockridge. My curing in AA involved basically going to the 12 o'clock, the 3 o'clock, the 5:30, and on days other than Tuesdays and Thursdays, when the 7 or 7:30 is a women's meeting, I would go to that meeting as well. And then I would end up going to the Late Show, which is down at Central Office. And I did this every day. I recently put up a visualization, actually, this is not a plug for that at all, on YouTube of like 250 and 90, because I added up everything that was in my journal. And it was a really dense set of meetings. At this point, I didn't have a sponsor for my first month. But then I was at the Lakeshore Lushes. And I decided to have Ryan be my sponsor, because he had originally, when I was still drunk and going to meetings, led me around with my little paper guide and said, hey, this guy's name's Julian. He's really cool. Hey, can you give him his phone number? And he really just harvested for me all these phone numbers. And I just thought that was, and as I learned more about AA, I realized that was really proper behavior. That was, he was really doing his thing. And I asked him if he'd sponsored anybody. He says, yeah, I've got a sponsor. And I've got a sponsor. And I didn't really get that whole, like, my sponsor's got a sponsor, you know, kind of thing at the time. I was like, well, that's great. And he became my sponsor. So I started working the steps. The first one was truly easy. I accepted that I had no control over alcoholism. The second step went well as well. I was willing to look for more spirituality in my life, and I was willing to work on that. Ultimately, my fourth step was the most difficult for me. I had no problems doing my harms. Quickly made a list of those. I'd learned about sexting at some point in the last 6 months before that, and was grossly abusing that when I'd get drunk. Horrifying women that were my friends, and not like, you know, in an intimate way, like, these are your friends. And so, you know, anyway, that's just all part of the stuff we do, and I'm trying not to dwell on that much. Because after I started my fourth step and quickly got through my harms and my fears, you know, I'm 54 years old. I have no problem coming up with fears. You know, will I die alone? Will I relapse? Things like that. I got stuck on my, the other part of my fourth step. I'm sorry, I got a bit nervous. Anyway, I didn't know that they didn't have to be about alcohol. And so basically I started going through them. And just before I did a speaking engagement last Monday at Rockridge, the night before, I worked on it really hard, and it took no time at all to come up with, and I'm still farting on the word, but anyway, that part. The what?
Resentments?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. I was having so much trouble coming up with resentments, because I blame myself, or at least I see my role in all the things I did, and so naturally it's hard for me to be resentful about it. It's more like embarrassed. But I did have a bunch of resentments of all sorts of things. Once I freed my mind of thinking it has to be just about booze-related things, because they are emotions that drive you. And I finally got through my fourth step, and I'm really proud of that, because now I'm going to contact Ryan, who has been nice enough to just silently wait for me to get my act together, and actually read my fifth step, which I'm really going to be proud to do. I want to work the steps more. I go to a ton of meetings. I have a meeting every night. Actually, I took Wednesdays and Saturdays back, and I was bored tonight and thinking, I'm going to go check out the Saturday meeting again. Because meetings AA has a social aspect to it, and it defers depression, actually. I looked up, why is AA, you know, meeting, why are so many people going to so many meetings? Because I see a lot of the same people intersecting at my meetings, and the odds of that statistically, I can't work out on my feet, but it means that a lot of these people are going out to a lot of meetings, and they have, like, a lot of sobriety, people with 23 years and 19 years and all these things. I'm running into these people all the time. It turns out that meetings help with depression and all sorts of other things. But basically going to meetings, that's why I think it's really popular, among other things. So I go to a ton of meetings. In the evenings, I say a simple prayer, which is, thank you. And in the morning, I say a simple prayer, which is, please. And I'm still working on the God aspect of AA, but I've also found out that's a common problem that we're all working on. Going to meetings regularly, going to fellowship, I find is really important. A number of my meetings go afterwards, and we call that fellowship. Again, that plays to the sort of social aspect of it. But we take over restaurants, a bunch of people that aren't going to be leaving a big bar tip. you can sort of see us coming and sort of put away the basket and be like, all right, well, I'm going to seat them over here. But we have a good time with everybody. Again, my name is Julian. I am an alcoholic. I've come to learn that. I'm facing all the classic aspects of alcoholism. Now that I'm sober, I'm showing up. I'm showing up at places. My parents aren't young. I'm showing up for them. I have more money because sobriety, you're not spending $80, $150 a night on booze. My apartment's clean. I occasionally buy myself flowers and put them in a vase just to celebrate that, like, I have a home again. So anyway, I'm going to keep it at that. And I'm really, really happy to be speaking. I didn't come here to speak tonight. I'm so glad this came up. My higher power, there is such a thing for me, I think was involved in this. So thank you guys very much.
I'm Natalie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Natalie.
My sobriety date is April 21st, 2009, and I'm really pleased to be here. So thanks for having me, and thanks a lot for stepping up. It's a pleasure to hear you. So 35 minutes, okay. Yeah, so I've been sober a little over 10 years. I got sober in San Francisco. And I've been an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous in several different fellowships since then. San Francisco, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, back in Las Vegas, and I've been in Oakland for about 6 years. And it's fun to be in this meeting because I can remember when I had first moved back to the Bay and I moved to Oakland, and this meeting was over in the other spot before, and it was like super packed. And I hadn't lived in Oakland before, and it had been a number of years, and I didn't know anybody. And I remember going to this, like, super packed meeting. It was, like, all fucking punk rock. And, like, I was like, oh, my God. I felt, like, so on the outside. I remember it was, like, I had already been sober, like, 5 years, and I had been, like, really involved in all of the fellowships I had been in, and I remember getting back and just being, like, wow, I'm, like, basically feeling like I'm starting all over again, which has been my experience every time that I've moved, actually. It's been, like, I'm new all over again with some more experience and resources, and I was just thinking on the way over here, it's nice to be here because I am, like, so on the inside of Oakland Alcoholics Anonymous at this point. Like, I feel so comfortable in this fellowship. I know a lot of people in this room. I love Oakland AA. I have a home group that I love. I go to a women's literature meeting every Wednesday, and we're, like, right out of the book and right in the steps, and I know those women, and they know me, and I get to hand out chips every month and hugs for birthdays, and I go to a pretty fair amount of meetings. I sponsor lots of women. I have a sponsor and always have, you know, and so it's funny. Like, it's really nice to be here and just feel like I put a lot of work into being in the middle of this fellowship, and it's just such an honor, you know, to be a, you know, I think a generally trusted member of Alcoholics Anonymous as far as things go. I don't know. We'll see in 30 minutes from now. But So yeah, it's good to be here, and I'm just going to try to stick to the general format, and 30 minutes is a pretty long time, but I really like to talk about recovery, so I'll probably spend more time on that end of things. But I'm from L.A. originally. I grew up in L.A. I grew up in Venice. I grew up in a neighborhood that I just don't even recognize anymore. Very, very different. It's actually really interesting being in Oakland because it feels just like it felt in my neighborhood once upon a time. Things are changing in a very, very similar way. And my parents got divorced when I was 3 years old, and it was a nightmare. It was terrible. I'm, you know, practicing as a therapist now, getting hours, and I've worked with kids for the last couple years. And it's super intense, you know, working with kids and being like, wow, like it was like fucked up how things went down in my house. And like, I watch kids and I watch what happens when things happen, how they happen, you know, where I grew up. And there was just, it was just a bad scene, you know. And I started my journey into mental health and that whole world when I was 3. So I got put into therapy when I was 3 because I used to, like, bang my head up against the walls and, like, throw myself at things and self-harm. And I was, like, sticking stuff in myself in the bathtub and just, like a really disturbed child from a really young age. And so I started, you know, getting help really young, or help, you know, supposed to be helpful. And I just had a really hard time when I was a kid. And my parents did the best they could, and it just wasn't really great. You know, my mom was really traumatized and really unavailable, and my dad was really depressed and really angry and liked to drink a lot of vodka. And so my earliest memories of alcohol when I was growing up was my dad would basically drink himself to sleep every single night because he was so sad. And like, we didn't really mind when he drank, and my mom would say the same thing because he was, like, pretty docile when he would drink, but, like, he was a really intense guy, right? And so, and I remember, like, when I was young, my dad used to drink screwdrivers and White Russians, and if you're 5 and you know what a screwdriver is, you know, it's like, I remember being young, and my dad would drink, and he would drink White Russians, and I would, like, sip on White Russians. They're so good. And he would joke, he'd be like, careful, you're going to turn out just like your dad, you know. And it's funny, like, looking back on that stuff now, where I'm like, you know, it's funny, I just turned 40 last month, and, like, I've been reflecting a lot on my life, you know, and sometimes it's, like, these little flip books of things, and, like, I'll see something like that, I'm like, wow, that's really interesting that he would say that when I was, like, 5, you know. So, yeah, so I just had a lot of problems growing up. I won't go into all of it. I had a really hard time at school. I had no concept of how to connect with other kids. I never felt like I understood how people were, like, actually friends. I did not grow up in a house where I got any of that stuff where, like, you feel like you're cared for, or there's, like, warmth, or you feel like you're important to your parents, or, like, I didn't get any of that at home. And so I just wasn't, like, really wired to learn how to be intimate with other human beings at all when I grew up. And I definitely, you know, there's a story in the Big Book where there's this kid on the playground, like, watching all these other kids on the playground, and this kid is basically, like, has, like, just, like, doesn't get it. And that was, like, pretty much the story of my whole childhood. Like, I just did not understand how to connect with other people at all. And my family are immigrants, and so I got this full ride into this private school, this, like, French private school in L.A., so I was, like, a pretty, you know, working class to poor kid, and I went to school with a lot of very, very, like, pretty much the most affluent sect of LA. Like, I went to school with lots of really rich kids, and, like, I was so embarrassed because, like, I lived in Venice, and at the time Venice was just hood, and, like, I didn't want anybody to know I lived there. So from the very beginning, it was like I didn't want people to know a lot of things about me and my family. And and eventually they kicked me out. They got sick of me in 10th grade. And I started going to public high school. And things got really different. I started smoking weed, and I just was not interested in school at all. And my parents weren't that interested in me, and so there wasn't really a lot of pressure to get really involved. And then I was going to take the GED, and then the night before the GED, I ate a bunch of acid, and I missed it. And so I ended up going back for my senior year, and basically worked it out that I got out of school at like noon every day, and I just just kind of go smoke weed. And I did not stop drinking. I did not start drinking when I was young. I was like way more interested in drugs when I was young, and really into psychedelics when I was in high school, and had some really profound spiritual experiences, actually. And you know, it's important for me to remember that there were actually some really great times for me when I was using. You know, I had some really sweet experiences. I was like really into the Grateful Dead and like psychedelics, and I'd like run around the forest and just like get really high and listen to music, and like it was really beautiful a lot of the time. But I never felt connected to other people. I always felt like I was alone in these groups of people, like I just could not understand. But I felt really connected to drugs, and I felt really connected to these experiences, you know. So I would say, so there's lots of things that happened. I don't want to go through all the details of my life. I moved around a lot. My first great love was psilocybin. My second great love was MDMA. My third great love was cocaine. And then finally, in my 20s, I really discovered my love for alcohol. And I had been living overseas for a while. I had gone overseas to study abroad and ended up dropping out and staying out there a couple more years, and had a partner at the time, and there was just a lot of drugs, and I had this double life, and I was teaching, and I loved teaching, and then when I was not teaching, I was up for days, and so I just had a really hard time knowing how to manage the whole thing, and I ended up getting really depressed. And I decided to move back to the States because I thought that I would come back to the States and, like, clean up my life. Like, California, I'm going to go get my act together. I'm going to live this, like, really healthy, wholesome life. And I moved back to California, and that's just not what happened for me. So what ended up happening for me is I moved back, and I got, you know, I was really involved in the restaurant and bar industry, which in my experience is really just a lot of really sort of glamorized, glorified alcoholism. And so, you know, when I look back on my life, you know, what I didn't know then that I know now is basically almost every decision that I made in my life was a decision that would support the way that I wanted to drink and use. So for me, it was like working in that industry meant that I was around alcohol all the time. Pretty much everybody was using. I mean, I don't know how it is now. This is a while ago. I'm assuming it's the same. But, like, alcohol and cocaine were just kind of like a regular diet in all of the places that I worked. And I really developed a relationship with alcohol. Like, a relationship, like, it was really, like, the most intimate partnership that I had ever had was with alcohol. It was the most reliable. It was my boyfriend, it was my best friend, it was my hobby, it was like all of these things for me. And I loved it. I loved having it in my house, I loved having like all kinds of liquor in my house, I loved going out and drinking all the time, I loved that when I went to bars people would like know me, and I thought that that was like a special thing. But then I started having a lot of consequences. I was getting fired from jobs, I was, you know, causing a lot of wreckage in my relationships, and things just started kind of progressing for me. And then finally, you know, I got fired from, I don't even know what happened. Basically, one day I was like, I'm sick of this, like, restaurant. I'm sick of the rules. I'm sick of all these rules. And so I decided to start stripping. And that was a monumental turning point in my life. You know, for me, it was like even being in places like bars and restaurants was not enough freedom to drink for me. And so I got hired at this club. I got hired on days, and you know, I love Bill's story in the book. And one of the things I love about Bill's story is like the details of his life look nothing like my life. But the progression of his alcoholism and his internal experience and the way that he related to his life looks everything like my life. And I remember when I started, you know, working in clubs, and there's this whole part in Bill's story where he's like talking about golf and being on the golf course, and like he could like just run around and like he was tan, and everybody was like, it was like his excuse to drink and pretend it looked good, basically. And that's how it was for me. You know, I got hired on days at first, and I would go in at 11 a.m. and it was just dark in there all the time, and I just drank all day, and I just wanted to be there all the time. It was like I had found this perfect little dark corner of the universe where for the first time in my whole life I could just fucking relax. And it was the first time in my life ever that I felt like I belonged somewhere. And it got really dark for me really fast. So I had been there for like 6 months or so, drinking and using and just, you know, being a degenerate, basically. And I had already been fired once in like my first couple months. And I was working one night, and long story short, I blacked out. Apparently, I got fired again. And then I woke up the next morning and I was in somebody's living room. I had no idea where I was. And it turned out that the gentleman that I had been spending time with, who turned out to be an angel, had brought me home. Like, they had sent me home with this person. And I just remember, like, waking up in this living room. I was like, I don't know where I am. I'm pretty sure I got in trouble last night. Pretty sure it had to do with some combination of prescription pills and whiskey. And thank you. Perfect. And so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. It had been suggested to me over the years that I might want to check this place out eventually. And so it was kind of like in the back of my mind that maybe, you know, maybe I had some kind of problem with alcohol. And so I started going to meetings, and I don't know, there was like something about it that I knew I belonged here. You know, I knew that there was like stuff that I was hearing that I could relate to. But I was convinced at that time that my problem was cocaine, and that if I could take care of the cocaine problem, that I could probably get my act together. And really, what I really wanted, to be completely honest, is I was doing so much blow at work that I stopped making money. And when I came into AA the first time, I was like, I need to get my shit together so I can go back to work and make some money. So like, whatever gets you here, you know, like I wasn't even interested in getting sober particularly at the time. And I stayed for a while, and I got a sponsor, and I started on the steps, and I did this thing that I have seen over and over and over and over again with the women that I work with over the years, is that I had all this enthusiasm for the first three steps, and then the fourth step came around, and I started to kind of feel like maybe I didn't really need to be here, and I thought that I was just changing my mind, and so I kind of slowed down on the steps. I didn't continue with the inventory. And one night I was at work and somebody offered me a drink and I took it. And then I drank for another couple years. And it was not always bad. It wasn't like just this straight downhill thing. It was way more like what they talk about in More About Alcoholism, where like it felt like it was kind of okay for a while. And then it would get like real bad. And then it was like kind of okay for a while, so I was kind of convinced that it might be okay. But like, there was something that happened for me because I had been in AA, and so I had these AA ideas in my head that it just, over the course of time, it just became completely obvious that something was just not right about the way that I relate to alcohol and drugs. I don't know that there's anything right about how anyone relates to drugs, but for me it was clear that there was something about alcohol that just was not working. And then nothing really spectacular happened when I came back in. You know, I had been on a bender for a few days. I really liked whiskey and Norco at the time, and I I woke up one morning and I was just really, really sad. It was pretty simple. I woke up, I was really, really sad. I didn't feel good. And you know, as I mentioned before, my family were like basically refugees and had this crazy story to get here. Like unimaginable story to me, what it took for these people to get here and build a life here. And my grandma pretty much raised me and my brother. And like I had this moment of clarity where I was like, wow, my family went through so much. Like my grandparents like worked in like fucking sweatshops for like nothing, you know, and like saved money, bought a home, raised kids. My mom got to go to college, you know, like, and like all I want to do is just fucking drink. And I felt disgusting. It was like after everything that they went through, like this is what I'm doing with it, you know? And it was just like, it was gross. I just felt gross. And I went right back to AA. And I mean, this time I was ready. Like I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. Like, you know, I could not play the game anymore. I knew that I had alcoholism. And so when I came back, I was really ready to do the deal. And I got a sponsor right away. I got a sponsor that was really hardcore, not particularly likable. and she told me exactly what to do, you know. And one of the things that was really impressed upon me when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was this wasn't just like a thing that I was going to add into my life at my own convenience. It wasn't like I was going to do my life, and then I was going to go to AA and kind of like do a little AA and then be in my life, and it was like this extra thing. It was that actually now, like, this is the structure that my entire life is being built on. It was just like this complete reorientation around how I looked at my life, that I don't just sprinkle in AA. Actually, what I do is I give myself entirely to recovery, and then from that structure I will build a life of my dreams. And I had no idea what that meant at that time, you know. And so for me, you know, I had to call my sponsor at the exact same time every single day. There were a few things I had to say on her voicemail. She didn't want to know about my life. She wanted to know the meeting I was going to. She wanted to know who I was calling at the exact same time every day. And if I called like 3 minutes late, she'd be like, "What's up, dude?" You know, and now I understand that. It was because she really wanted me to know that, like, I was making this commitment to AA. I said I was going to call at this time, and I was to call at that time, right? And sort of just, like, training myself in this new way of life and in humbling myself to what it meant to be really dedicating myself to this thing. And that woman took me through the steps for the first time, straight out of the book. And she took me through the steps in a way where it was completely clear to me how to take women through the steps. And I have taken many women through the steps that way, and they have taken many women. I have, like, great grand sponsees now. Because it was also impressed upon me when I got sober that we get sober to sponsor. And we get sober to get other women sober. And you know, it's I'm just so grateful for that kind of sponsorship early on, because it was so clear to me. Like, this is the most important thing now. You know, she told me, she said, your home group is an 8 a.m. Saturday morning meeting. This meeting too early in the city. It's this huge meeting still today. And I was like, no, it's not. It's like, I work until 3 or 4 in the morning on Friday. I'm not going to. And she was like, so your home group is an 8 a.m. Saturday morning meeting. And I did. I would work and I would go home and I'd sleep like 3 hours and I'd get up and I'd go to the meeting and then I'd go back home and I'd go back to sleep, you know, because that's, and then I fell in love with that meeting, and then I stopped working Friday nights, and then I got the fruit salad commitment, and I would spend, like, all Friday evening, they would give me $15, and I'd add, like, another 15, I'd get, like, fucking mangoes and kiwis, and I'd do, like, all this loving kindness practice, like, the whole Friday night, and then I had a whole plan about the ones that had to be cut on Monday mornings, because the apples will get brown if you cut them Friday night. It was, like, this whole thing for me, you know, and it was, like, wonderful. people. You know, I had no idea. And so we go through the steps and this whole thing. And then, you know, at 10 months sober, and I was still dancing at the time, like all, you know, ambitious dancers, I moved to Las Vegas. And so I ended up moving to Las Vegas and getting straight into the Fellowship of Las Vegas, which is glorious, believe it or not, like super old school, like just awesome sobriety. And I hooked up with a sponsor there, and they do this thing when they go through the steps where for the first 100 and whatever it is, 84 or whatever, you do this thing called line by line. So you write a line from the book, and then you write on that line, and then you write a line, and then you write on that line, like literally every single line. And so this is like how I went through the steps the second time. So I got to really know the book, right? And I had these actually really incredible experiences with going through the literature. Luckily for my sponsees, I don't sponsor that way. But, you know, I got to really know the literature in a whole new way. And then I moved to LA and I got a sponsor there, you know, and I went through the steps again with that woman. And then when I was about 3 years sober, I hit a really dark spot and I got horribly depressed, like horribly borderline suicidally depressed, and was doing all the AA and was doing all the things. And it was just a really dark time. I had never experienced that in sobriety before. And what happened is I had to really, you know, make some big decisions about, you know, my life and reinvestigate for me what it looked like. Is I had to really reinvestigate this whole relationship with a higher power. Like, that's what it came down to for me. Like, nothing made sense. I'm sure plenty of people in here have experienced mental illness of all sorts, and, like, nothing made sense to me at that point. Like, I just, like, didn't even, nothing made sense. And so I ended up taking a whole year and doing a lot of really intensive practice. In my practice, we sit these silent retreats, so we just, like, sit quietly for many, many days. And so I took a year, and I did a lot of retreat, and I did a lot of AA, and I did a lot of meditation, and I started looking around at, like, what people were doing that had lives that I wanted, and who the people were that really inspired me, who seemed to be living lives that were, like, really purposeful. And, you know, in doing that, I realized, like, wow, a lot of the people that I really love and care about and inspire me have all been therapists at some point in time. You know, they've all worked as MFTs, or they've all worked in this helping profession that actually sounds like a pretty good fit for me. And so I decided to go to graduate school. And, you know, moved back to this area to be able to go to graduate school to become a therapist. And so I have about 10 minutes. So there's some stuff I actually do want to talk about. I've been in Oakland now for six years, and I did put myself through graduate school, and I am building a career as a therapist now. And, you know, one of the things that has become really interesting to me over time, is like all of the ways that alcoholism shows up in my life over the years as I get more and more sober. You know, so like I've had all these different ways that, you know, there's like layers that come away over time. There's so much I want to say about this. I'm trying to figure out how to condense it. Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, I feel like I'm in this place where it's like, you can only do what's right in front of you. You know, it's like, I only have the resources available that I have in this moment to do the best that I can in this moment. And that has looked really different over the years in sobriety. You know, I gave up alcohol, I gave up drugs, but then it was like, man, all these other things, like working, money, hustling, cutting, sugar, food, exercise, like there's so many different ways that, you know, I've found over the course of like the last 10 years that I have tried to take care of myself. you know, like ways that I've tried to manage and control my life to feel okay, you know, and like when those things are happening, it's like, why is this happening? Like, why am I, like, I'm fucking 8 years sober and I'm sitting on my bathroom toilet and I'm like cutting my leg open because I'm incapable of feeling the feelings that are coming up for me right now. And that's absolutely right. I was incapable of feeling those feelings at that point in time. You know, like, why am I 7 years sober and I'm on like the fourth fucking ice cream place in a row? I feel sick. I'm going to sit here until I don't feel sick so I can keep going and I can go eat more. Like, why is that happening right now? Right? Like, it shouldn't be this way. This shouldn't be happening, you know? And it's like, no, actually, this is actually the best that I can do right now with the resources that I have in this moment. Right? And so there's like all this stuff I hear a lot in AA about like letting go and take away my fears and like all this stuff. And you know, one of the things I've had to do over the years of sobriety, because, you know, I don't believe in God. It's fine. Most of the people I know don't believe in God. I've had to really develop a language about what the higher power thing is. I have my own 7-step prayer. I have all these prayers of my own that work for me, right? And one of the things for me in sobriety is, like, I cannot be forced to let anything go that I am not ready to let go of, period. I cannot force myself. No one else can force me. No higher power is going to take my fears away, right? So my job in sobriety, as far as I seem to have learned, is that I need to do all of the things to cultivate conditions where I'm just ready to let go on my own, right? And that's been my experience in sobriety. You know, I have all my own theories about human animals and, like, we just want to be safe, right? I just want to be safe. I'm just an animal. I just want to be safe. I was raised a certain kind of way. I had to take care of myself a certain kind of way. It was incredibly resilient. It's like, just when I think about how, like, resilient I was as a kid, like, the shit that I came up with to take care of myself, like, not counting on other people, not relying on anyone ever, learning how to take care of myself, like, that was actually incredibly adaptive, right? But thank you. Over the course of the years, it's actually become incredibly harmful, right? And so for me, like, part of what I've learned in sobriety is, like, I cannot force myself to stop doing things until I feel safe enough to stop doing them. And so a lot of sobriety for me has been, like, how am I building a life that feels safe enough for me that I don't have to do that shit anymore? You know, how am I building a relationship with a higher power where I feel safe enough and held enough that I don't have to manage that shit anymore, right? The 11th step for me is, like, everything rests on that thing for me. Like, for me, and this is just my experience, you know, everyone will say something different. For me, it's all about developing this ongoing relationship with a higher power. It's, like, all about sitting on a cushion in the morning and getting quiet and doing my prayers and doing my stuff and learning what it means just to sit with what feels uncomfortable, right? And learning what it means to develop safety, like, in my own system. Like, learning what it means, like, when stuff comes up, not to, like, beat up on myself and be a dick to myself and make myself feel like things should be any other way. Because the truth is, if they should be, they would be. If they're not, it's not time yet, right? And so, like, for me, it's, like, showing up for sobriety every day, sponsoring women, which is the joy of my life. It's the greatest joy in my life, sponsoring women. You know, sitting on a cushion, doing the meditation, looking at the defects, being like, oh, this was probably a really good idea at some point in time, but, like, in this conversation, it's probably a really bad idea. You know? And just to, like, hold all of those things. So, yeah, you know, I'll just finish up by saying, I am, like, really more happy and free in my life in this moment in time than I have ever been. Ever. And a lot of things have happened in my life recently that have been really challenging. Some of my closest friendships have ended. You know, I haven't spoken to my dad in about a year and a half because it was too painful. a couple months ago, I decided for the first time in my life to start talking to my mom about some stuff that happened when I was a kid that I've never talked about before. And a week later, she told me it was so traumatic for her to hear that she cannot have me in her life right now. You know, like, this shit is painful. But I'm like, oh, okay. This is more stuff that I get to take to the cushion and sit with and check it out and, you know, sponsor other women about, because they're going to go through the same thing at some point in time, and it's okay. I just turned 40. I'm between internships. I'm about to go to Asia for like 6 weeks by myself with a backpack with no plan, you know, other than to just like see what's supposed to happen. You know, it's an exceptional thing, really. Yeah, it's a good sober life, you know. If it was supposed to happen any differently, it would have happened differently. So this is clearly how it's supposed to be happening right now. So, thank you.
Thank you.